Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. Today's guest is someone who broke a family tradition of running into burning buildings to jump headfirst into startup fires instead. Joe Seeger Dupuy is a director at True, the B Corp VC reshaping consumer and retail from the inside out. He's backed some of the boldest founders out there, and he's here to talk about what it really takes to build and invest in a better future. Joe, such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Amazing. Joe, so let's start with this one. How do you explain your job? I read it somewhere. I think there was an interview with you or something. So I wanted to ask again, how do you explain your job to your five-year-old self?
I think fundamentally it's about helping people build new things. I think venture capital is one of those weird jobs where it's really simple, but it's definitely not easy. So really it's about creating an opportunity to bring resources to people with amazing ideas and helping them get things off the ground. And obviously, as an investor, the most obvious resource is capital. But alongside that, particularly at True, we try and bring expertise and network from our broader portfolio and ecosystem focused on consumer and retail to help those companies alongside just providing the capital.
Sounds good. Actually, it's pretty clear, pretty straightforward. You actually soon won't have to explain it to five-year-old self, but to your five-year-old daughter. So you better practice doing that, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think my five-year-old self would have no idea what venture capital was at all. So it's quite, it's been a journey of discovery. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, nice. Joe, from firefighter roots to future shaping VC. How did pivot happen?
Yeah, I guess the fire service is kind of the family business in some ways. So I grew up in a county called Suffolk in the east of England. My dad spent his entire career in the fire service, so 32 years of service for Suffolk Fire and Rescue Service. And he was actually following in the footsteps of his dad. So my granddad was also in the fire service, also in Suffolk. And then I have two older brothers. The sort of pattern continued. They are both now in the fire service, one in Suffolk, one in Bedfordshire. And so I'm pretty much the odd one out, the youngest of three boys.
You break out of the family business, come on.
Yeah, I've broken out of the family business. And ironically, I think I was probably the one who was most keen on the idea of following my dad's footsteps and going into the fire service when I was young. But I was also always quite entrepreneurial as a kid. I was, you know, buying and selling things online and got really interested in that. And then I decided to go to university so that I could study business and learn a little bit more about how that world works. And then I think, you know, one thing leads to another. You sort of meet interesting people, you broaden your horizons and your ambitions. I then started a company out of the back of university with a couple of friends, and the sort of entrepreneurial and startup vibe was just captivating for me. And one thing has led to another, and I've now found my way into venture capital, which is obviously very different to what my brothers and dad do and did. I do try and kind of keep some of the values and principles that they've taught me and sort of apply them into this role as well. But it's obviously very different worlds. I definitely couldn't do what they do. So I'm hugely proud of them, even though it's very difficult to come to common topics of conversation around the dinner table in relation to work, but that's probably a healthy thing.
Nice. I love it. I love the story. Joe, True is a B Corp, a VC, and a retail consumer innovation engine. What's the superpower in that mix?
I think there's probably two superpowers. I think the first is we are pretty passionate believers in the power of vertical specialization. So everything that we do at True is focused on the consumer and retail sector. And it has been since the founders got started more than 10 years ago. And that kind of shows up more tangibly for founders in the sense of broad kind of expertise mm-hmm. of having been on the journey of investing in and operating companies and more than 60 companies across the world in the consumer and retail sector, all different types of business models, different geographies, etc. Which has helped refine a kind of a playbook, if you like, or a set of knowledge that sits both within True itself and in a broader network. And then I think the network is really powerful alongside that expertise, because things are changing all of the time. And the most important thing is being able to connect founders to people who are going through the same challenges that they are mm-hmm. and can really help them navigate that from a position of credibility with operational expertise to help them solve those problems, regardless of what they are. And the problems often rhyme across consumer businesses, right? Whether it's tech mm-hmm. or consumer products or consumer services, fundamentally, it's about how do you build a great brand? How do you build a brilliant product? How do you go to market from an acquisition perspective and retain customers? And how do you build the kind of operational engine to support that? And so the specific manifestations of that will change depending on the business and the model, but there's a lot of commonality there that we can try and help support founders with. And then I think the second superpower is our business model at True is quite different to quite a lot of other funds out there. We actually have three different investment strategies. So I help run the venture capital fund, which is pre-seed to Series A, focused on primarily technology-driven businesses in consumer and retail, either consumer-facing or B2B that sell into the consumer and retail vertical. So things like in-store technology or e-commerce software or whatever it might be. Alongside the venture capital fund, we then have a private equity fund, which is doing more kind of growth stage and buyout in consumer. So bigger, more mature businesses, a bit more established, but still highly relevant for all the reasons I just talked about in terms of helping provide visibility to founders of what that chapter of growth looks like. The third part of the investment strategy is a public equity fund. So launched late last year, we're now investing in public equities again in the consumer and retail space. So getting visibility of how public markets think about consumer and the opportunities that creates. And then alongside all of the investment businesses, we have an advisory business that's working with global corporates in the consumer and retail space, helping them navigate the risks and opportunities created by technology and innovation, and then connecting them with best-in-class vendors of software that can help them go after those opportunities. And so it's this sort of four-legged stool, if you like, and it's really powerful because it means that we're getting visibility of what matters from the earliest stage at the pre-seed and in some of the stuff that we're doing in the VC team, often backing literally founders with a plan. We can go super early. And then all the way up through the chain of bigger private companies and then into publicly listed companies as well. So we have this like really broad perspective across the entire life cycle, if you like, of consumer, in a way that if you were just operating at any given kind of vertical slice of that, you probably wouldn't have the same perspective.
Yeah, I wanted to say that sounds super holistic, like, you know, approach and like end to end. Like this is like you go all the way, all the journey throughout, which is great. Like it's all like, I wanted to say that, you know, given what you're focusing on and that you're a B Corp company, you know, we talk sustainable like all the time. What actually moves the needle beyond the label?
It's a good question. I think sustainability and I guess ESG more broadly has probably been on a bit of a journey over the last couple of years. I think it was very, very in vogue for a while. And then I think now in some areas, the narrative has switched a little bit and it's almost kind of gone back the other way. And I think there's a lot of, as is often the case in this space, there's a lot of kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as you say. It's like, the extremes aren't right. Like truth is right. Always somewhere in the middle. I think what's unavoidable is that the long-term structural trend is towards more sustainable consumption. There's so many massive drivers, whether that's regulation, whether that's climate change itself, whether it's consumers. The long-term trend is definitely right. I think the challenge can be, I think there's two big challenges. One, I think is, I think sustainability can't be a cover for asking the consumer to compromise on something they really care about. So I think there's certain circumstances where something like, you know, a new regulation or whatever can drive big changes in consumer behavior to evaluate options in a different way to how they had before. But I think the most powerful thing to do is figure out a way where building sustainability into the business becomes like a structural advantage. So if I think about, you know, some of the businesses that have done really, really well and have sustainability embedded in them, something like Vinted for secondhand clothing sales or Too Good To Go for surplus food, they have a sustainability angle, but they're also fundamentally just a great value proposition for the consumer. And that's what's allowed them to scale really, really quickly. So I don't think sustainability can be something that is a friction to the consumer adopting. I think it has to be more interwoven into the business model. And then I think the second big thing is like, it's one of those words where you can basically bullshit a little bit with the word sustainable and the sort of words around sustainability. And I think consumers are increasingly wise to that. I think if you're going to go down that path and make that a key part of your proposition, you have to do that in a super authentic way and not take shortcuts. I think about, like, there's a company in our portfolio called Shellworks, which is building fully biodegradable alternatives to plastic for packaging for the beauty and personal care sector. And every time I speak to that team, I'm amazed by how deep the thinking is on how to be truly sustainable, not just in the product itself, but in the manufacturing processes, in the inks that they use to print the decoration on the product, in the end of life kind of journey beyond their scope. Like, how does the consumer actually interact with the product, and how does the product need to fit into that? And so it's one of those where you just keep double clicking on it and there's more and more depth behind what they mean by sustainability. And I think if you don't really have that, I think it can be quite dangerous to put all of your eggs in that basket if you're actually building it on a bit of a house of cards, if that makes sense.
Nice. I actually agree with that point. Joe, I know that you've doing research on you, I found that you've said brands now need a point of view, not just, you know, a product. Can you give us an example of like who is nailing that?
Yeah, I think the step back point is that so product is really, really, really important. Okay, so we'll probably talk about this a bit later, and having a great product to back up a brand is critical. But at the same time, the distribution side right now is so hard. There has never been easier to launch a brand. There's so much out there, and you have to find a way to cut through the noise. And I think particularly in a venture capital context where we're looking for those really high, you know, high growth outlier businesses, and you're looking for the extraordinary outcomes, you can't get extraordinary outcomes by doing ordinary things. And so I think often there's a temptation to try and be all things to all people, but actually I think being different is often better than being good. And I think being really passionately loved by 10% of the consumer base and being willing to either ignore or even alienate the other 90% can often be a really powerful way to get things going. And often it's a question of choosing what not to do, right? I think the canonical example for me is like when you look at what Steve Jobs did when he came back to Apple in the late 90s, he basically cut 70% of the product portfolio and just focused down on the most important things for solving the problem and going after the opportunity that he thought there was for Apple. And so that takes bravery and that takes conviction and that takes a real point of view on what the brand exists to do and to deliver. I think another example more recently is recently listened to a podcast from the founder of Clueli, the US-based business. And he talks quite a lot about how they've used quite controversial marketing messages to spread virality on social platforms. And whether you kind of agree with that strategy or not, it's different. And I think they've clearly been able to cut through in a way that's pretty extraordinary. I think another example I'd use, the Jaguar rebrand, I think was fascinating, right? Because it was so divisive for so many people. And at the same time, you couldn't have asked for more earned media if you were Jaguar. and being willing to be really different, have everybody talking about you, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, whether you like it or not. Now, when they actually launch their next set of cars, a set of vehicles, there's going to be a much more coverage of that, and much more awareness and eyeballs looking at that new range, because they were willing to take a bold stand and do something very, very different. So I think there's lots of different ways you could play it. I think the most important thing is to not, obviously you don't just want to copy and paste what other people have done and try and do exactly the same thing. You have to be authentic to your brand and do it in a way that makes sense. And again, it's different to what other people have done before. But I think if it feels like you're not a little bit uncomfortable in the way that you're communicating about your business and your brand, you're probably not taking enough risk, in my opinion.
I love it. I love that take. Joe, so D2C's, you know, gone from darling to punchline. Is it dead, evolving, or misunderstood?
Again, I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Very diplomatic answers.
It's definitely not dead, right? But I think the playbook has changed. I think D2C is an incredibly important channel for loads of reasons. I think it's where you have the most control over the storytelling, the presentation of your brand. It's where you have the best end-to-end control of the customer experience. It's where you have the best opportunities to collect first-party data, to get really tight feedback loops, to try new things. And, you know, often for a lot of companies in the early stages, it's a key way to kind of prove some initial traction and prove initial product market fit. I think the disconnect is that it's not the be-all and end-all from a distribution perspective. It certainly can be, and there's certain categories and certain products where it works really well, and there's certain categories and certain products where it doesn't, and that's okay. It just means that the distribution mix has to be different for those types of products. And I think, you know, if you're trying to distribute to customers in a way that they're not ready to shop, or there's not a clear incentive for them to shop directly with you, then it's going to be tough, right? And I think particularly with increasing competitiveness of online marketing, we all know that CACs have gone up. The kind of unit economics can be quite challenging, and the growth algorithm that worked for a long time probably doesn't work anymore. That doesn't mean that D2C is not an important part of any business today. I think the most important thing is to try and come to a really clear point of view on what the role of D2C is for your specific business and your specific brand, and be really thoughtful around how you're measuring what success looks like in that context, because it's going to be different for everybody. And again, if you just try and copy paste what a different brand in a different category is doing and apply it to your business, then you're probably missing the nuance. But it's definitely, it's definitely not dead. It's a fun, again, a structural tailwind for people to want to interact directly with brands and in an online context, but it just requires a bit more nuance than smashing money into Facebook ads.
Right. Awesome. Joe, you invest where consumer behavior shifts. What shift is just getting started?
Am I allowed to say AI, or is that too boring?
No, you can totally do that.
Okay. AI. No, but I think what we are excited by is that the AI moment has created a pretty unbelievable set of opportunities to reimagine existing customer experiences and to create entirely new markets. It's kind of phenomenal that, you know, I think it was November 2022 that ChatGPT launched, and that has really catapulted Gen AI into the mainstream consciousness at a speed that we've just never seen before. You know, lots of people have talked about it, but all the precedent kind of infrastructure, if you like, both from the kind of the back end and also the front end consumer devices, access to the internet, etc., was already in place. And so the adoption has been enormous. And anytime there's a big technology shift, it creates new ways to rethink existing markets, new ways to serve existing use cases. So for example, one of our portfolio companies, Jitty, is building an AI native property search platform, property portal. in the short term with a long-term view to building a much more agentic way of finding and buying your ideal next home. So that's really exciting and allows you to do things that the incumbents just can't or fundamentally won't do. And then there's a whole swathe of entirely new markets that get opened up, particularly with Gen AI, where you have often, you're sort of relieving the supply side constraint of things that were historically performed by humans. So we think about a lot about things like private wealth management or therapy or even legal services. Yeah. You know, historically, those weren't really that widely available to the mass market consumer because the cost to serve was so high that the price point just couldn't make sense for the average person. If you can find a way to deliver that service well through software, all of a sudden you unlock like the 90% of the market that was previously blocked out, which is incredible.
It's amazing.
And then at the same time, there's that element, and then there's the whole shift towards more agentic experiences. And that's going to create a whole new set of consumer behaviors and required infrastructure and just change, right? Change in volatility in the way that people are living their lives is good for venture capital, creates the cracks for new companies to get started. And so we're obviously super excited about it. I think it's both, it's true. The two things are true at once. It's probably overhyped and there'll be lots of things that don't work. And it's also probably underestimated and it will be much more fundamental and profound than people think. And the devil is in the detail of trying to pick, be the right end of that spectrum, basically. But we're super excited by it.
Yeah. AI it is. It's hard not to mention AI with this kind of question.
I know, yeah. It's boring, but it's...
Yeah.
It's like the kind of macro why now, right, for consumer. You can just... The rules are being rewritten and that's the best time. Yeah. To be a founder or an investor in early stage innovation.
100%. Joe, I know that you've worked with, both Branson's family office, which is quite interesting for me, and early stage founders. What did each teach you?
I think the common thread that's clear across both, I think there's two. I think one is... just how important a truly special founder is. I think Richard Branson was and is kind of iconic as a British entrepreneur. He was sort of 20 years ahead of everybody else in terms of going and building companies and taking risks and doing things differently. And he really inspired an entire generation of entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, a lot of what we were talking about earlier in terms of doing things that others weren't willing to do and embracing that being willing to be different. I think he was like very early on that trend. And we see it today, right? It's the same set of characteristics that willingness to do things that other people aren't willing to do and to really think differently. That's so crucial to startups and basically taking on, against the odds, the task of building something from scratch. At the same time, I think the second thing that I learned a lot from the way that Richard Branson builds businesses is the importance of building a team around the founder that can be complementary and handle things that the founder either can't or won't do. So Richard's always been very open publicly around where his strengths lie. And he's been very vocal about the importance of putting great people in to run the businesses alongside him who can handle or who are more inclined to do some of the stuff that he can't or won't do. And again, the same goes with the founders, right? I think the ability to attract talent towards you, to storytell to people as well as to investors, and be really clear and self-aware on what the areas are, almost mapping like the areas that have to go right from the business perspective and where the gaps are in the founding skill set, and being really surgical and in filling those gaps with great people is definitely a commonality across the two. I think more broadly, like family offices are obviously very different from a context perspective to a venture capital fund. So there's lots of learnings in the detail of how to think about venture capital as an asset class. But I think in terms of the core commonalities of what we're trying to find when we think about entrepreneurs, then those things stand out for me.
Awesome. Super interesting, by the way. Joe, also, you kind of answered what I wanted to ask you next with what you were saying about like what entrepreneur should do or what entrepreneur should look like. But I also know that you called, you know, Airbnb the wish I thought of it startup. What do today's Airbnbs, you know, in the making have in common? Like what's a founder quality that signals this one's got it?
So yeah, Airbnb I think is a great example of the venture capital model working because it sounded like a completely crazy idea that would never work. And, you know, tens, if not hundreds of investors said no. And then they went on to build one of the largest hospitality businesses in the world in, you know, less than 20 years. So it's a great example of like, you have to do things that seem a bit crazy and are outliers by definition. And then work to kind of figure out how to make it work. I'd love to say that if I had the access at the time, I would have seen through it, but I probably would have said no, because who know, you know, who's going to let you sleep on a sofa in their front room? It just, it felt like a crazy idea. I think on the question around the best founders, so we talked a little bit about willingness to do things differently and ability to attract talent. I think the other thing that I find really compelling when speaking to founders is when they have clearly thought so deeply and interrogated an idea or a problem so much, mainly to kind of validate for themselves that it's worth dedicating, you know, 150% of their life to for the next 10 years. Right? I think the best founders are, they're really hungry for feedback and critique, and then they fold it into their framework of how they're thinking about the business and what has to go right to make it happen. So they're not just selling a pitch deck to raise capital. You know, there's certainly an element of being able to sell that's really important, but it's also a journey of discovery on like, what are the reasons people think this won't work and how do I as a founder de-risk those things? So I think on, you know, for Airbnb, I think a couple of the things they did early on, they were using cross postings to Craigslist, I think, to acquire the supply side to try and solve the cold start problem. And they sent in their own photographers to take pictures because they saw that high quality pictures led to higher conversion. So I feel like they, I mean, I don't know the team well, which I did, but it feels to me from reading the story, again, in hindsight, it's kind of, they took all of the reasons why people said it wouldn't work and then got comfortable that those things were overcomable and then set about focusing on those things to prove the next set of milestones to raise the next amount of capital. And I think that that intellectual rigor to take on board challenges, think them through and decide, you know, is this something that I need to address as a priority, or, you know, is it, you know, is it just an excuse from an investor who doesn't know what they're talking about? I think that that real kind of intellectual rigor is a key characteristic, I think.
Nice. Joe, Airbnb got like hundreds of no's. You said that maybe even you would have said no back then. So by the way, what's a past no you still think about, or like, and what made you hesitate? Do you have that? I think every investor would have it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that I've been at Tree for 3 years, so I can't say there's been any that we've said no to that yet have proven to be the kind of Airbnb success. But I'm sure we've said no to stuff that will go on to be great, you know, great outcomes. And I think this is a job where it's almost structurally set up to make you feel stupid most of the time. So we have to be okay with the fact that we'll probably miss things. I think probably that one of the hardest things in consumer is market size and getting the market right. I think Airbnb is a great example of that. I think Uber is a great example of that. I think often you're kind of looking for proxy markets that, you know, whether it's black cab market for Uber or the bed and breakfast market for Airbnb. And you're trying to say, okay, well, if you get penetration of that market, then X, Y, Z could happen. But the reality is the best consumer businesses change consumer behavior. They change the calculus between the consumer's different substitutes to do that job or solve that problem. And so they can draw people in from adjacent markets in a way that's quite unpredictable. And so I think that has been not for me or for True necessarily, but more broadly, one of the challenges with the consumer is that often the outcomes can just be much bigger than you thought. And so getting that bit right can be really, really tough.
Nice. Joe, so we've been talking about, you know, like great founders, what great founders should have, what great businesses should have, like what startups need to succeed. Let's flip it a bit. What's one idea founders pitch all the time that makes you think, maybe not?
I don't want to pick any specific idea because
okay,
that might be wrong. No, I think if we go back to AI, I think one of the things that we struggle with is anything that feels like it's very closely adjacent to where the state of the art is today. Because the pace of change is so quick that I think there's a real chance you just get subsumed in the next feature release for one of the big guys. I think the difference with historical technology shifts versus AI is that when you read things like The Innovator's Dilemma, often what has happened in the past is that the new technology has been underestimated or disparaged by the incumbents. And so the startups sort of build critical mass under the cover of darkness, if you like, until it's too late. I think what's different about AI is that you have effectively every global business, particularly in tech, laser focused on how they can use AI and leverage it into their products. And they already have established distribution. And so I think it's really important to be clear around why the incumbents can't or won't do this. Knowing that they're putting so much resource into it and they have kind of cash volcanoes that are funding the CapEx and the OpEx to do that. And so I think you just have to believe that you're doing something that the big guys can't or won't do. And even though you might get traction in the short term because you're solving a problem with a point solution, I think the long run durability of that can be quite challenging. So we definitely encourage founders to think deeply about that.
Awesome. Joe, this is the time in the podcast where I usually play a little game with my guests. Okay. I call it rapid fire. So because I ask like quick questions, you give me quick answers. Are you up for it?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. So this is going to be consumer culture edition of the game. Let's start with this one. If consumer VC had a reboot, what's one rule you'd throw out?
The growth is the only thing that matters. I think it's important, but it's kind of necessary, but not sufficient. I think retention is underrated. And I think trying to hit vanity metrics for the sake of a chart that goes up and to the right is a waste of everyone's time.
What's one product you secretly love that you'd never invest in?
Probably wine. Like, I really like wines. Really like.
Are you a secret wine lover? Come on, it's better not be secret, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I just think it's like it's an artisanal product. It's got great story, provenance, history, connection to the environment. Like, I love it as a consumer, as a business. Yeah. Like, declining category, terrible return on capital. Really hard to differentiate. Really hard to scale. So maybe as a lifestyle business one day, but nice. Definitely not as a. As a venture backable startup.
So what's your favorite wine? What do you got? Red, white, dry, sweet?
I mean, my wife is French, so I probably red won't be safe dry. To go home if I don't say something French. And I got married in Bordeaux, so let's just go. It's boring, let's say that.
No choice. Good. Joe, worst consumer trend you wish would disappear forever?
I think D2C fast fashion, I think, is, you know, the kind of ship directly from a factory the other side of the world, a single piece that's, you know, worth a five or a tenner. It just feels like it doesn't work. Like, talking about sustainability earlier, as a business model, as a negative impact on the world, I think we need to be more thoughtful about that and maybe shift a bit more towards quality over quantity.
Founder you'd call DM if you could invest in them today?
Daniel Ek. I think the founder of Spotify, incredible first principles thinker. Again, there was a thousand reasons why Spotify would never work, and he made it happen. He's now doing Necco, which I think is a really interesting business as well. And I think he's one of the kind of generational European entrepreneurs. I think a close second is probably the Collison brothers of Stripe. Only because every time I hear either of them speak, I just think they're incredibly smart. But yeah, I think if I had to pick one, it'd be Daniel Ek.
Amazing. What's one startup that made you go, how is this not already a thing?
I think On Running probably doesn't get the airtime it deserves. Because who knew that in 2010 when they started that the world needed another shoe brand? And yeah, at the same time, like over the course of 15 years, they're now $15 billion market cap business. So I think they've just done an incredible job. It's probably one of the biggest outcomes of the European ecosystem in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years. And I don't think it gets the airtime that it deserves. But again, like seeing that pitch in 2010, being told that there was a big opportunity to build a brand in athletic trainers. Yeah. I think that would have, that probably would have been a, you know, there's no real why now. There's no, all of the tropes that you hear in VC. So you would have assumed that it's a solved problem, but clearly not.
One piece of VC advice you think is absolute bullshit?
I think any piece of advice that is copy and pasted without a sense of context can end up being bullshit. By which I mean, you know, people often give advice based on a historical situation that had its own set of idiosyncrasies and circumstances. And so that can be a useful input for a founder, for sure, to see how it was done in one context. But I think it's so important to unpick it from a first principles basis and figure out if it's relevant for you. I think the other thing, at least we try to do when we give advice to founders, is to differentiate where we're talking as from a position of expertise and experience with real kind of, you know, substance behind it versus simply like one person's opinion. So I think, you know, if you're a founder and you're listening to your VC and they're talking about, you know, funding dynamics, the current market, cap table dynamic, whatever it might be, probably weight that quite heavily. If your VC is opining on like specifics of the business, if they haven't built that business before, then probably take it with a pinch of salt. And I think being really clear about from what position is this person giving me this advice is really important.
Joe, last one. If you had to pick one brand to build your personal merch, who's designing it?
There's a brand based in London called Painter Jackets, who I love. They're absolutely not VC backable. They basically do 4 batches of made-to-order jackets per year, all pre-order, zero waste. When they're gone, they're gone. You can't actually buy anything from them for 90% of the year. So very much focused on kind of quality over quantity, which I really like. And I think I'm not sure there'd be many buyers for merch related to me, to be honest. So the model probably works from that perspective as well. So yeah, I think those guys.
Awesome. Joe, thanks so much. One last thing that, you know, when I was doing research on you, that got my attention and I liked it because we have that one in common. Whether you like, so I can let you know if I get there first, or I would like you to let me know if you get there first.
Okay.
I've heard that you want to work out with Chris Hemsworth. I would love to do that as well, man. So if you finally arrange that one, please let me know. I want to join it.
All right. Yeah. We'll figure out a way. I'm a bit concerned it might be one of my more unrealistic ambitions, but let's see if we can get there.
Awesome, Joe. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I had so much fun having this conversation. I loved it. I think the audience will love it as well. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.